This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. President George W. Bush will accept his party's nomination in New York City Thursday night, a week and a half before the third anniversary of 9/11. While the president is expected to talk about the economy, education, and Medicare reform, the centerpiece of his speech and his campaign will be strength and leadership in time of war. History offers mixed lessons on the re-election of war presidents. On the one hand, Americans have never voted the commander-in-chief out of office while troops were in the field, precedent that goes all the way back to the War of 1812. On the other hand, Presidents Harry Truman and Lyndon Johnson decided not to try their luck amid unpopular wars in Korea and Vietnam. So what does the public expect from a president in wartime? How does war change a White House and a presidency? What questions does history raise about presidents, wars, and elections? Later in the program, politics in Iraq as rebel cleric Muqtada al-Sadr embraces the ballot box, and we'll check in on pre-convention activities in New York with comedian Brad Stein. But first, war presidents. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN@npr.org. Joining us now is historian David Greenberg, a frequent contributor to Slate magazine and to NPR's Day Today. He joins us by phone from Martha's Vineyard in Massachusetts. Good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thanks for having me on.
Is it fair to say that history shows American voters are at least reluctant to change commanders-in-chief in midstream?
That's certainly fair to say. But I think what we tend to forget is the flip side of the equation, that we tend to romanticize the wartime commander-in-chief as commanding a near unanimous approval from the public and having an easy cakewalk to re-election. And that's not always been the case. Lincoln had a hard road to re-election during the Civil War. FDR didn't have it in the bag in 1944. And as you mentioned in the introduction, Harry Truman and Lyndon Johnson both thought their chances of getting reelected were poor and chose not to run again during those unpopular wars.
The very term itself, war president, seems to carry a fair amount of freight. Of course, it's a president who's president during a war, but what else does it connote symbolically?
Well, I think what we look for in a military leader are traits that are different from those we typically look for in a president. But when the nation is at war, we want the president to exhibit more of those general-like qualities: tough, decisive leadership, the ability to unite a people behind him, quick, tough decision-making, the qualities of Bush's that he touts, his so-called moral clarity. Those are the qualities I think we associate with a war president, whereas a domestic peacetime leader will brag about different traits.
Well, might not war leadership also encompass qualities like skillfully maneuvering an international alliance?
Well, certainly, yeah, and John Kerry's challenge in this campaign has been to also portray himself as a credible wartime leader, while at the same time not trying to out-Bush Bush. He realizes that his own traits are different ones that he can bring to bear, and so things like rebuilding our alliances, a more prudent brand of wartime leadership, is what's going to bring voters over to his side.
Where do these conceptions come from? I mean, of course, our first president, a couple of minor things aside, I mean, he wasn't president during wartime, but we certainly think of George Washington as a war leader.
Certainly, and there have been many generals throughout history who have served as president, Andrew Jackson and up through Dwight Eisenhower. And I do think that, you know, in the absence of other natural stepping stones for the presidency, you have basically governors, senators, and then generals or military leadership has been the other natural avenue. So it's not unnatural that we should associate these very prominent positions of national leadership coming out of the military with those that would also be suited to leading the country.
But the presidents that a lot of people might cite as their models of war presidents, Abraham Lincoln and Franklin Delano Roosevelt, I don't think either of them served in the military.
No, that's correct. Although FDR did have experience as an assistant secretary of the Navy in the Wilson administration. And so he had been through World War One in an important administrative capacity. So in a way, that does count as some wartime experience.
We want listeners to join our conversation. The number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, TOTN at NPR.org. Let's talk with Michael, who is with us from Brookline, Massachusetts.
Hi.
Hi.
My point is that when something is said to be a war, we tend to give the president more latitude. It's a lot easier when he encounters opposition to be told, don't you know there's a war on, moron, as they used to say during World War II. And so that means it's a great temptation for a president to call whatever they're doing a war, whether it be against poverty, which is, you know, not something you can fight with an army, or drugs, which shouldn't be a matter of law to begin with, or cancer, or evil, which will always be with us, or terrorism, which is a tactic which is used by a certain group of people whom we need to struggle against, but not necessarily with an army. But again, the main point is, it's presidents get so much from our being at war that they have great incentive to say that we are.
David Greenberg, do you agree?
I agree entirely, and I would make a further point. I think what Bush has done with the rhetoric of war on terrorism and the fusing of the Iraq war and the war against al-Qaeda into one ongoing effort is also, in a way, an effort to reignite the dynamics of the Cold War, which really served the Republican Party well. For many decades during the Cold War, the Republicans were seen as the party of military strength and of national security more than were the Democrats. During the 90s, as the focus shifted to domestic issues in the home front, you saw Bill Clinton and the Democratic Party enjoy a resurgence. So I think Bush and the Republicans see the attacks of 9/11 as an opportunity to put national security issues and military issues and a war back on the front burner.
Michael, thanks for the phone call.
Welcome.
Let's bring another historian into the discussion. Robert Dalek is a presidential historian and current fellow at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire, and he joins us now from Dartmouth Studios. Good to have you back on the program.
Thank you, Neil. Nice to be with you.
Last time, I gather you've escaped the National Archives, which is where we talked to you last.
Yes.
You've done biographies of John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson, both of whom were involved in the Vietnam War. Of course, Lyndon Johnson much deeper than John Kennedy. Johnson's yes. career was defined by that war. Indeed, some people still refer to it as Johnson's War. At what point does a war become a defining moment for a president?
Well, I think as soon as you deploy men in the field and lives begin to be lost and treasure begins to be expended at a considerable pace, and also when it diverts the country from domestic efforts, which it certainly did with Lyndon Johnson. He kept saying we can have guns and butter, but of course that proved to be quite false. The guns and butter never go together. In fact, in every major war the country has fought, reform efforts were pushed to the side. The Spanish-American War pushed populism aside, progressivism sort of died on the vine with World War One. Roosevelt said that Dr. New Deal has given way to Dr. Win the War. The Fair Deal was pushed aside by the Korean War, and Johnson's Great Society came a cropper in the Vietnam War.
And the aforementioned War on Poverty along with it.
Yes, of course.
Yes. Now, as you look about this, we were talking about perceptions of war presidents and how that affects their popularity in times of re-election. I want to ask you a question about where politics and war intersect. The conventional wisdom is presidents make the case for war. The military takes it from there. Is that often the case?
Well, it used to be during World War II, George Marshall, who was quite rigorous about this idea of separating politics from military commitments and activism. He would never laugh at Franklin Roosevelt's jokes. He didn't want to be taken in by this master politician, and so he stood aloof and was determined to make decisions based strictly on military strategic considerations as opposed to political ones. Of course, politics is never far behind when you're involved in a war. Presidents are politicians. the old saying, a politician's first goal is to get elected, his second goal is to get reelected. And if they are going to come up for reelection, they're thinking about how the war is going to serve their political purposes. I don't want to be too cynical and say that this is the primary concern, but it's certainly something that never leaves their minds.
David Greenberg, wasn't it Georges Clemenceau who once said that war is much too important to be left to the military?
Right, or was it to the generals? I forget the exact quote.
Yes.
But
yes.
I think Bob is right, that there's inherently a political element to war, even as many presidents have tried to respect the difference. And to say, as I said a minute ago, that George Bush sees 9/11 and the war against al-Qaeda as a political opportunity is not to be cynical and say that it's not a real threat, this wasn't a real terrible tragedy that happened, or that it should be something that should be absent from the political campaign. It's absolutely right for Bush and Kerry to be debating how they will handle this ongoing threat.
Yeah, I agree with David entirely. I mean, this is a democracy, and normally you have selective service or draft. Now we have a volunteer element in this one, but still, the public en masse is affected by this, and it's very much on the public's mind, and so it deserves to be front and center in this presidential campaign.
Let's get a call in. Alan joins us from San Diego.
Hi, Neil. It's unfortunate that there's not really a viable candidate that's clearly articulated that it's time to end the war and the occupation of Iraq and bring our troops back home to their families and loved ones right here in the United States.
I assume you're dismissing the viability of Mr. Dader then.
Well, you know, at the very least, the men and women of the military deserve to have competent leadership. And with new leadership, with a leader who will honestly assess the current situation in Iraq without the baggage of the original pretext for this war, then we can move forward and get our troops back home where they deserve to be.
Alan, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you, Neil.
And his call raises a question, Robert Dalek. Have there been successful peace candidates, I guess going back to George McClellan, wanted to make concessions to the South?
Yeah, well, they certainly become important in presidential campaigns when there is the feeling or fear that the war is stuck or we're vulnerable somehow. And the David mentioned before, and he's quite right, Lincoln was quite vulnerable in 1864 until there were a series of victories shortly before the November 1864 election. So peace candidates, indeed, in 1968, Eugene McCarthy and then Robert Kennedy were brilliantly effective and, in essence, forced Lyndon Johnson to quit. Eisenhower was very effective that way in 1952. He didn't say he'd end the Korean War, but he promised to go to Korea, and what was implicit in that was he was a military man who would know how to end the war, and Harry Truman was stuck there and didn't know how to do it.
And then there is the curious case of President Richard Nixon, who actually campaigned twice as a man who, with a plan to end the war. Let's listen to Richard Nixon back in 1969.
After 5 years of Americans going into Vietnam, we are finally bringing American men home. By December 15, over 60,000 men will have been withdrawn from South Vietnam, including 20% of all of our combat forces. Let me now turn to our program for the future. We have adopted a plan which we have worked out in cooperation with the South Vietnamese for the complete withdrawal of all U.S. combat ground forces and their replacement by South Vietnamese forces on an orderly, scheduled timetable.
Vietnamization, as it was known, would not succeed, David Greenberg, but in I guess I've only left you 30 seconds, but Richard Nixon as peace president.
Well, he certainly ran twice as a peace president, but he skillfully split the difference by having his program be, his slogan be, peace with honor. So it wasn't immediate withdrawal the way McGovern talked about in 1972, but it was, you know, a patient peace, a negotiated peace, a peace that would retain America's standing in that fraught Cold War time.
We're talking about war and how they affect the presidency, and we're taking your calls, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email TOTN at NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan, back after a short break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about war presidents as the Republican National Convention gets ready to nominate George W. Bush on that campaign later this week in New York City. Our guests are historians Robert Dalek at Dartmouth College and David Greenberg, who's a frequent contributor to the online magazine Slate and to NPR's Day to Day. Of course, you're invited to join us. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email TOTN at NPR.org. What qualities do you expect from a president during wartime? And I'd like to ask you both, in terms of a campaign as a war president, Robert Dalek, doesn't a president leave himself open to the vagaries of what can happen in a war?
Well, of course he does, because as somebody said to me just as this Iraq war was beginning, the only thing you ever control in war is the first shot. And we should be learning a hard lesson in this conflict in Iraq, because we controlled the first shot and several shots after that. But since the alleged end of the war, we've entered into a kind of urban, miserable civil strife that we can't seem to control. And it really is reminiscent of Vietnam, when that jungle warfare escaped our powers of control. And so Lyndon Johnson, for all the power he had as president, for all the power the United States had, and the same exists now. We can't seem to control these events. We really need to think much more carefully about history and demography and geography before we go into one of these conflicts, because I think they can tell us a lot about what we may face once we are ensconced there.
David Greenberg, parallels to Vietnam and the Lyndon Johnson presidency?
Well, certainly. I mean, I don't think you have seen, it took many more years for Vietnam to turn, for the American public to turn against Vietnam the way they really seem to be turning against Iraq. I guess the public is more or less divided right now. But it is sort of fateful timing coming up in this election year has really been the bad year for George Bush in Iraq. If the election had been last year, even by November, things weren't going so well, but it probably would have gone very differently. And I think Bush mistimed the war. I think I would never suggest that Bush went to war for political reasons, but I do think that the reason he rushed to war and wanted to get that war over with in 2003 was with the election year in mind, and events did get out of his control. It couldn't be wrapped up as neatly as he and his team hoped it would be.
Let's get another.
I'd just like to
go ahead, Robert. Go ahead.
Very quickly on the point about Vietnam. You know, this, of course, is not Vietnam. The analogy is terribly imperfect. But this war in Iraq comes in the shadow of Vietnam. And the reason David said very quickly now, we've seen a divide in this country over the war. It took a much longer time during the Vietnam conflict to reach that divide. But we have the backdrop of Vietnam, and so this is on people's minds, and they are thinking that, my goodness, is this another example of being stuck in an unwinnable war? So I think Vietnam casts a long shadow over this war in Iraq.
And as you say, the parallels are imperfect. North Vietnam in those days clearly had major allies in China and the Soviet Union. The Iraqi insurgents could only hope for such allies. And anyway, let's get another caller on the line. Mark is with us from Toledo.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for the call here. I just want a little bit of clarification. You opened your setup saying that no president has been replaced during a wartime election. How many presidents besides Lincoln and Roosevelt have actually run for office during the midst of a war? And, you know, does that make this argument of we shouldn't do it because it's never been done before valid?
David Greenberg?
Well, let me try to think. I mean, certainly you could make the case that, Nixon won re-election during the Vietnam War. The War of 1898 was winding down, but McKinley was still a war president when he won re-election. Generally, presidents in wartime have been re-elected. I don't know what a statistician would say if those are enough examples to make this watertight. Certainly, history doesn't predict the future, and I think anyone would tell you this election could go either way.
And Lincoln, of course, and Roosevelt, as we mentioned before. Would you accept, just for the purposes of argument, Robert Dalek, I guess the Iranian hostage crisis wasn't exactly a war, but Jimmy Carter was certainly beaten during it.
Yeah, and it was certainly an international crisis that cast a long shadow over Carter's presidency. So in a sense, you could say it was a kind of war that he was confronting, and it did go far to defeat him.
Mark, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. And Robert Dalek, we wanted to thank you for your time, as always.
Thank you.
Robert Dalek, presidential historian, current fellow at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire, and he joined us from the studios at Dartmouth. The White House is always a turbulent place. It changes in time of war. Stephen Hess worked in the White House under two administrations, under President Eisenhower in a time of peace, under President Richard Nixon during Vietnam. Currently, he's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and he joins us here in Washington from the studios at Brookings. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
If I'm not mistaken, you were the Deputy Assistant for Urban Affairs under Richard Nixon. Tell us about your experience. What was it like to try to push a domestic agenda while the president was and a lot of other people were preoccupied by the war?
Yeah, this was 1969. The president had just been reelected. Of course, he would like to have gotten to us, but he had something in the way in the meantime. If I could set the scene, our office was in the West Wing in the first floor. If you came in and you turned left, there was the office of my boss, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, and I was basically his chief of staff, the office next door. Mm-hmm. If you turned in the other direction, you had the Situation Room and Henry Kissinger. And most mornings, if I'd come in at the same time as Henry Kissinger, I'd say something like, Henry, when are you going to settle the war so we can have some money to solve all of our problems at home? And he would say something like, Steve, why can't you have some good riots in the street to distract the media so I can settle the war in Vietnam? But the point is, it was always on our mind. It never left our mind. For example, one day I looked out the window, my windows in the from the West Wing, looked out over Lafayette Park, and there was a fence around Lafayette Park. And I called upstairs to John Ehrlichman. I said, there's a fence around Lafayette Park. He said, oh, yes, a lady who was a great philanthropist has given us money to re-beautify the park. So we've put up a fence at the time. And I said, John, have you any idea what is going to be on that blank fence tomorrow morning? And he said, oh, my. And I said, what should I do? I said, well, John, if you can get some paint, I can get the school children of Washington to paint a mural. There was not a home rule at that time. Our office actually was, in a sense, the district government as well. And he did, and the school children painted a marvelous mural. So it never said all that graffiti. And in fact, when we finally took it down because the park was re-beautified, the Smithsonian called and said, couldn't we have that mural? And I said, we just threw it out. I'm sorry. But it was constantly like that. The idea that if you looked out the window, you had to worry what was on the fence. We were, in a sense, fenced in.
What was the most difficult part of that job? Was it obviously the lack of money for urban issues, or was it the lack of access, the lack of ability to promote an agenda?
No, I don't think the latter. The president was very generous with his time. It was the early administration, of course, so a lot of that time was spent in planning. So it wasn't that, but there wasn't any money available. And in fact, by the fall of 69, I had changed jobs, and I became the national chairman of the White House Conference on Children and Youth. And that was a very difficult assignment, and so, because I wanted to go out on college campuses. I wanted to show young people that the administration, even though they might not agree with us, were willing to listen and to go out and be met by howls of protest was not exactly fun. I mean, I can remember once going to the College of Worcester, about an hour south of Cleveland, and a young woman cursed me in language that I guess only Dick Cheney now uses. And afterwards, I was sitting in the green room waiting to leave, to go, and there was a knock on the door, and she came in, and she said, you know, excuse me, obviously you know how I feel, but I should never have talked to you that way. And I thought that was very kind of her to apologize. And I asked where she from. Well, she was from Arlington, Virginia, and her father worked for the CIA, and she was taking out all of her problems with her father on me. So it was like I spent the next 2 years doing something like that. The war was just a daily presence.
Let's get some more callers in. Chris is with us from Delray Beach in Florida.
Yes, thank you. Enjoy the show.
Thank you.
I just had a comment. I tend to feel that the current administration, at least, uses the fact that they're at war with terror in Iraq, if you want to blend the two, as almost like a coverall to the issues that are going on here at home. They keep going back to 9/11 because of the fact that it is an unpopular war. They can't say, look how well we've done in the war in Iraq. They say, look how well we're doing in the war on terror. And I just think they're using it as a way around the issues.
To avoid domestic issues? Is that what you're saying, Chris?
Correct, yeah, to avoid the domestic issues and the fact that a lot of the policies that the president says and the administration say they support that are popular that they don't fund or you know, just to avoid the issues that I think the American people want to hear.
Let's get a response to that. Was that the case when you were involved in this conflict, Stephen Hess, during the Nixon administration?
Oh, no, that wasn't at all. Remember, Richard Nixon inherited this war. What was always, I thought, so fascinating was, in a sense, it was Johnson's war. Johnson, of course, not only another president, but not of the same party. How did it become Nixon's war? How did he allow it to become Nixon's war? Well, there was this sense of not wishing to be the first president who would lose a war. And it was as if he was stuck with like tar paper with that war. We heard a few minutes ago his speech about getting troops out of there. Well, it wasn't fast enough by any means.
And he put them into Cambodia on the way.
That's right. That's right. So there wasn't a sense. Nixon had some quite remarkable domestic programs there. In fact, by August of 69, he had proposed something called the Family Assistance Plan, the first time of a guaranteed annual income to poor people in America, in a sense of a negative income tax. So he was very anxious to be rid of the war and somehow, for whatever reasons, could not rid himself of it.
Well, let me bring David Greenberg as we go ahead to this week. We're told we're going to be hearing a lot about compassionate conservatism, an idea that has, not taken center stage, I guess, since 9/11 so much. The president said not all that long ago, nobody wants to be a war president. He'd rather be a peace president. Where is this balance between the domestic agenda and what Chris calls the caller Chris calls the desire to overlook domestic issues with the war on terrorism and in Iraq?
Well, I think that comment of a few weeks ago by Bush that he wanted to be a peace president was made in recognition of the failure or at least the lack of a rousing success of the war president strategy. In other words, things in Iraq have been going very badly since March or April, and to persist in saying all is fine there and we're just about to turn the corner wasn't persuading voters. And I think Bush realized that you do have to be able to say, I'm going to be a responsible war president that I can recognize when the American public has had enough of war. And I do think that he's now got a very tough line to walk because his strongest card remains those images after 9/11, the way he did have a measure of national unity behind him, you know, in the first couple of months after the September 11th attacks.
Chris, thank you.
Thank you very much.
We're talking about presidents in wartime. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Rick joins us on the line from St. Louis. Hello, Rick.
Hello?
Rick, you're on the air.
Yes. What I wanted to say was that there seems to be a difference when we talk about war presidents. For instance, Roosevelt was very different. He had a clear definition of what victory would be. Since, if you want to go, Korea was kind of in between because you still had pretty good demarcation of who was where and who were the enemies and where they were. Once you got into Vietnam and you got into a true guerrilla force, it seemed to me definition of winning had to be changed because by definition you cannot beat a guerrilla force. And we tried it with Agent Orange. We tried it with the Scorched Earth Policy. I mean, as long as there's somebody to fight you, they will fight you, which relates to these homicide bombers, et cetera, right now. So I think definition of what it means to win, if I were running for election, I would want to define what I mean by victory.
Mm-hmm. Get back to that. Stephen Hess, as you look at that, clearly this was an eternal problem during Vietnam. It's not, to put it as Rick, they couldn't defeat that, couldn't win in that guerrilla war, not to say that any guerrilla war can't be defeated. But
yeah, I think he's right, but it's more a question of whether there's a government or not, whether you can, whether there's somebody who you can surrender to or can surrender to you. The question of the present war is, if you went to Paris and put who would sit around the green table? So I think that's really the problem right now.
And
that's you put it more clearly than I did. That's really what the situation is.
That's why they pay him the big bucks over there at Brookings.
You better tell that to somebody who might listen.
Well, let me put that same question, though, to David Greenberg. The nature of the war clearly seems to make a difference, not only how well it's going, but there's a difference between a war that's I guess the current phrase is existential threat, where the country itself is at stake. Second World War would certainly qualify in that regard, as opposed to a war of the quality of Korea, Vietnam, and perhaps Iraq.
Certainly, and I think the earlier caller on the program who talked about these metaphorical wars, the war on cancer, the war on drugs, and so on, made a very good point. The war on terrorism is sort of in between one of those metaphorical wars, meaning just a strong effort, and a real live shooting war. If you call the war on terrorism just what we did in Afghanistan, well, in that case, George Bush was very successful. He deposed the government. We put in our own government, and there's certainly problems remaining in Afghanistan, but you can credit him with certain success. Same with removing Saddam Hussein from power. But what I think this administration hasn't really done is think about when real war turns into something vaguer and something more ill-defined, how you do define victory in such a cause.
Rick, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
The senator from Vermont who said you declare victory and go home, remember?
George Aiken.
George Aiken, yeah. He had a fine answer to that question.
Stephen Hess, thanks very much for being with us today. Stephen Hess served in both the Nixon and Eisenhower administrations, currently a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution, and he joined us from the Brookings studios here in Washington, D.C. And David Greenberg, thank you as well.
My pleasure.
David Greenberg is an historian and frequent contributor to Slate Magazine and to NPR's Day to Day. He's the author of Nixon's Shadow, The History of an Image, and he joined us on the phone from Martha's Vineyard. Today we're talking about war presidents. George W. Bush will run for re-election as a war president. He accepts the Republican Party's nomination on Thursday night. Joining us now by phone from the convention venue in New York City is David Sanger, White House correspondent for The New York Times. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
Always good to be with you, Neil.
Republicans are investing a great deal in President Bush's tenure as war president. I guess the nature of the campaign was to some degree dictated by the choice of the convention site and its date.
It was. The convention, of course, New York was selected for the convention shortly after September 11th. And for a while, in fact, there was some thought that the convention would sort of roll into September 11th remembrances. I think there's been a movement away from that in the past year, not because the president wants to move away from the sense of a war presidency, quite the opposite, but I think that there's a great sensitivity about not seeming to exploit the images of September 11th in the political context.
As we go ahead with this convention and this campaign, though, one thing that's going to be become evident is that, war presidents take a risk. It depends on how well the war is going.
It does, and of course this is not quite the picture of the war that many had in mind at the time that the action in Iraq began. I mean, we're 17 months, a little bit more, after the initial invasion, and of course there's still a quite active insurgency underway, even with this agreement in Najaf that was reached the other day.
Mm-hmm.
I asked President Bush about this in an interview that we had with him last Thursday in New Mexico during a campaign stop, and it was at that moment that he used for the first time the word miscalculation, that they believed that they had made the most limited of miscalculations, which was that they won the military victory too quickly and that allowed a lot of fighters to disperse into the cities and into the rural areas and come back as insurgents, and that they are dealing with that and adjusting to it. Now, many others, including some in the administration, believe it's more complex than that, but that certainly shows you how the law of unintended consequences has taken hold here.
And as war president, a lot of people draw a distinction between the war on terror. Well, it all began 3 years ago there in New York City. Afghanistan, they would say, was part of the war on terror, and the war in Iraq, which a lot of people say is a separate matter. That's a war of choice, a war of preemption. Are they two things in George Bush's mind, or are they one thing?
I think they are two parts of the same thing in George Bush's mind. They have to be in order to put together a case for invading Iraq in the absence of the evidence now of weapons of mass destruction. Of course, he didn't know that then. But I thought it was sort of interesting that the other day, Secretary of State Powell differentiated between the three and between three different types of conflicts, I thought, in a quite interesting way. He said Afghanistan was retaliation. It was, you know, the response as our war against Japan was a response after Pearl Harbor. Iraq, he said, was a war of preemption. That's a little bit of a loaded term, because preemption requires, of course, solid evidence that you're about to be attacked in its literal interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we didn't have that. But let's take his argument as he put it. And then he said Iran and North Korea, the other two members of the Axis of Evil, were cases of diplomacy, where we are seeking to disarm them diplomatically. He's making that distinction. You don't hear that distinction in the president's stump speech.
Let me read you an email we got from Kevin Murphy in Tyline, Kentucky. The administration will be the first to run for re-election during a war in which the president himself has started preemptively. It should be recognized this election will be a test of the very idea of preemption more than of the president's domestic agenda.
Mr. Murphy makes an interesting point, and I think that it may not work out quite that way in the minds of many voters, because you have to remember that preemption itself has always been an option for the United States. It was an option during the Cuban Missile Crisis. It's been an option many times in our history. What President Bush did differently was he raised it to the level of a formal doctrine. Now, what Senator Kerry has said is he would retain preemption as an option, but would take it away as a central doctrine, because the doctrine itself, he believes, creates unnecessary strains and alliances and animosities and concerns about the U.S. acting unilaterally. President Bush argues, and he argued to us as recently as last week, that that is a distinction without a difference.
Mm-hmm. There is also the question of a wartime president running as a wartime president when a lot of people in the country don't necessarily feel that they are at war.
Well, this is why you hear the president say so often that it's a different kind of war, and that, it's fought in places that you frequently don't see, and sometimes in battles that you don't hear about. But at the same time, most Americans, with the exception, of course, of those whose families are off in Iraq or out with the armed forces, many American families don't feel as if they have been asked to sacrifice. Whereas, say, during World War II or many other wars in our history, obviously sacrifices ran throughout the population. And that is an interesting distinction that I think may contribute to that psychology.
David Sanger, thanks very much. We look forward to your coverage this week.
Thank you. Always good to be with you.
David Sanger, White House correspondent for The New York Times. He joined us by phone from the site of the Republican Convention in New York City.